Hi, this is Susan Silverman.
I'm Bob Andelman, and this is a Mr. Media interview. And you can see, hear, and read more than 1,000 of my previous celebrity interviews at MrMedia.com. That's MrMedia.com. On today's show, I'll welcome Susan Silverman, one of the most unusual rabbis you'll ever encounter. Unless you know Rabbi Raquel Fine or my friend Bob Alper, the rabbi turned comedian, who I'm guessing Susan knows from her shaking her head. Rabbi Silverman is the author of a new book about adoption, Casting Lots, Creating a Family in a Beautiful Broken World. She's also the moving force behind communityadoption.org. Stick around. And speaking of comedians, Rabbi Silverman has one of those in her family, too. Rabbi Susan Silverman is a bit of an alarmist. Don't believe me? Just read her book. From the prologue, for example, page XI. At recess, I'd purposely get an out in kickball in exchange for my parents still being alive when the 3 p.m. bell rang and the school day was over. Oh, and on page 90, as a grown-ass married woman and mother, once upon hearing of a crash in Russia, I actually figured out how my husband could have ended up on that flight, a scenario that included a wrong gate and an absent-minded ticketing agent. I had recently spent half the night dialing and redialing the front desk of his hotel, asking the same clerk to put me through to his room. I'd left messages, but what if he didn't check them? What if the red light on the hotel room phone was out? What if he were lying dead in the gutter right now? One more from her. God created the world through poetic speech. I patrolled mine through vigilant bitchiness. All right, so don't misunderstand. I am not making fun of Susan, even though we both laughed a little. Okay, maybe a little. I am married. I know the drill. Now, as the firstborn child of Beth Ann and Donald Silverman, Susan experienced a horrific trauma. Her three-month-old baby brother died in his crib while her parents were on a short vacation and the baby was being cared for by Donald's parents, her grandparents. That 1964 incident, at least from my reading of Susan's new book, Casting Lots, Creating a Family in a Beautiful Broken World, colored pretty much everything that's followed in her life, from being ordained to raising a family of five, becoming an adoption activist, and relocating from Boston to Jerusalem. In Casting Lots, Susan tells her story, warts, four-letter words, and all, and makes her case for easing restrictions on international adoptions. By the way, I first became interested in Susan last summer when I heard the audiobook edition of her sister Sarah's book, The Bedwetter, in which the comedian, perhaps best known for her music video, effing Matt Damon, or supporting little-known candidates Barack Obama and Bernie Sanders, talks in awe about her big sister, the rabbi and mother. Rabbi Susan Silverman, welcome to Mr. Media.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really happy to be here with you.
Delighted to get to meet you. And I told you off air that when I heard your sister's book last summer, I thought, that sounds like a really interesting woman. She talked about you. She clearly loves her older sister.
Yeah, it's mutual.
Yeah. Well, all right. So I'm assuming, I'm going to jump right into this, but I'm assuming that, or am I assuming too much that Jeffrey Michael's death had a pretty far-reaching effect on your life?
I actually think it did. And the strange thing about that is that for years, I completely dismissed it as nothing because he was a baby. I don't even remember him. And it wasn't really until I was an adult and in therapy and talking about this like intense separation anxiety and I somehow mentioned that I had a brother who died when I was two. And she said, "What?" I had seen him for like 3 years already. Wow. And I was like, "Yeah, but it doesn't matter. You know, I was two, he was a baby." And she's like, "Susan, you know, basically wake up and smell the coffee." And it was really, wow, it really helped shift things a lot, as did Zoloft.
Well, and the coffee with soy milk.
Yes. Did I mention that in the book?
Yes, you did.
Huh?
I believe you had just picked up one of the boys and you went to a faux Starbucks and you asked them, right? Right?
Yes.
Hey, I like details. It shows that I actually read someone's book.
Totally.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I get the sense from reading the book that that had a big impact, and that collectively you're one of those people who would just like to, if you had the opportunity, collect up all the world's stray children, gather them up and bring them under your roof and mother them, basically.
I would like to see every single child in a permanent loving family. And that could be a variety of scenarios. I mean, you know, helping families, biological families, stay together, giving people the resources they need, and finding families, you know, in kids' birth countries, whether that be the U.S. or another country, and finding kids' families abroad. But the far, far, far last resort has to be institutionalization or, God forbid, the streets.
You've got to have some frustrating days, though, when you feel that strongly about it and you know that you can't, in a given day or a year, provide care for all those kids. I imagine there's just some days where you must just feel overwhelmed by the almost the hopelessness of it in some ways.
Yeah. And the people who are really smart at working at this stuff don't think about it in terms of the I think they don't think, oh, my God, we've got to get this done now. And that's how I thought for a long time, and I was not effective because I was so anxious about doing too much at once, and it just wasn't effective. And that really we need to consistently move forward, and we need to have a vision and a plan and to enact that. But as soon as we get, you know, what I get kind of like panicky about it and thinking, oh my God, right now children are, you know, living in institutions. Right now children are being sex trafficked. And it really actually kind of undermines the effectiveness of what we're doing, because we can't just think straight and have a vision and know that we can't fix it today and tomorrow.
I've known people over the years who've had that kind of commitment to, you know, a cause, basically, and you know, they're so committed, and then they get very frustrated because either they can't do it all in one day or in one, you know, week, or the people around them don't share the same commitment, and it just it can be frustrating, I guess. Very, you know, anxious.
Yeah.
And I should point out that you also had another experience, I think, when you were very young, where your parents had taken in a foster child, and you immediately, I mean, literally immediately, the very first day, decided this was your sister, and for a year she was your sister, even though Laura, I guess, didn't feel quite the same, but and then suddenly she's taken from you, and I'm guessing that probably added to this feeling that you've had for years as well.
I think there was anxiety around that for me, but at least my memory of it is sort of the sense of being like so dismayed that this reality existed, that there were children who didn't have families that took care of them like my family took care of me. And that is what really sort of stayed with me. You know, I think there was certainly a sense of loss for me, but there was also this, like, you know, I still have this memory of her being driven away and thinking, where is she going? She has no safe place in the world.
Yeah, the description was just really cut. It really cut for me because I just, you know, I've thought about foster kids before, and I thought it's great while they're staying with you and once they make the adjustment, but when they're yanked from that situation, and these kids who have it done repeatedly in their lifetime, just can't imagine how painful that is. And we usually think of the kid who's removed or placed in the situation, but if the family cares, you know, it has that effect across everybody. And so, tell me about the title of your book, because at first glance, casting lots probably doesn't connect for everybody, but it has very specific meaning for you.
It does. So, first of all, we were matched with our older son on Purim, and Purim is a holiday that the central part of the story is this concept of throwing the dice, casting lots. And so I liked that connection because it was connected to our son, and also this idea of kind of like taking a chance in the world, but it also means its very opposite, which is to cast your lot, right? To cast his lot with our family, to cast his lot, our lot with the Jewish people. There was sort of this sense of determination and its opposite. And I kind of liked that complexity and the contradiction. But there's also, like, because I come from sort of a theatrical family, you know, my sister.
No, not you.
But also our mom was a play director for years. She she formed a small theater company in New Hampshire that was a very, like, a wonderful small theater company. And so I like the idea of casting. You know, we cast our family. But there's also the cast, you know, that repairs, and there's the cast that solidifies. So it's all these sort of like opposite meanings and complexities, and I liked that.
I know when I made that joke, people were thinking, oh, he's referring to Sarah. But actually, no, I knew your mom was ran a small theater group for years and years, right?
Yeah.
Really, pretty much to the end of her life, as I
recall.
That's
right. Very close. Yeah.
So, and as you were describing casting lots, I was thinking about it also in terms of making a commitment. I mean, you're throwing the dice, but you're throwing the dice, which indicates some risk. But there's a bit of that because you don't know until you bring a child home from adoption and you spend years whether you've done well. But also your family and the child, you're making the commitment to each other. Is what
right.
I was thinking about.
That's right.
Yeah.
Which is not so different from my birth kids. I mean, it's all sort of casting lots. It's all taking a risk. Anything like that, becoming a parent.
Listen, I've got a 19 and a half year old, but I'm still going week to week with my wife, so I don't want to tell you what kind of a short leash I have my relationship with my child, you know. So a lot of people probably consider adoption at some points. There's people who have not been able to conceive traditionally, or they have a lot of space or a lot of love, but then they wind up not doing it. And I wondered, you know, if you want to talk to those people, you've got a forum here. What do you say to those people who think about adopting but then don't pull the trigger, so to speak?
Well, a couple things. One is I've created this organization called Second Nurture. And the idea of Second Nurture is that communities, multiple families from the same community, it could be a synagogue, it could be a church, it could be a non-religious community, a community center, or even a school or a neighborhood, where a number of families from the same community adopt, all either from the foster care system locally or internationally from the same country, or possibly even from the same orphanage. Hmm. And then you have a culture of adoption, a norm of adoption. Then you can share resources, you support each other. And I think there's this, you know, people imagine that having an adopted child is harder than having a birth child. And I think it depends on your child, right? I joke, but it's true, that if our daughter Hillel, our second child, who's a biological child, if she had been adopted when she was a teenager, she was such a nightmare that if she had been adopted, people would be like, you see what happens when you adopt. But she is biological. I mean, there are all kinds of stories. And I think often, especially with adoption, the hard stories surface. And certainly with some kids, older kids in particular, there could be different problems. But they're almost all dealable. And so first of all, I think that people are more likely to adopt, to get back to your question, if they feel that their community has their back. And I think that we should be more likely to have children at all if our community has our back, right? And that also, so I would say to people, you know, create a situation in which you can do it. I would say if you have that in your heart and the capacity in your life, take the risk. Look at all the people we admire who have risked so much on behalf of other people. Here, we're asking to sort of risk like the norm of your family as you know it, but probably to actually really, really enrich your life and your family if you can take the chance. And that I think we owe it to the kids of the world to put them in permanent loving families, because kids who are in institutions can go blind because they're looking at white ceilings as babies and their optic nerve isn't developed. Kids who are in institutions lose an IQ point a month because they don't have the kinds of interactions with adults that children need. There are all kinds of horrible things that can happen, almost all of which you can rehabilitate in a permanent living family. I mean, our son, who we adopted when he was 4.5 years old, which is still fairly young, but it's a full kid, you know, he's the only kid who gets, like, you know, the excellent student awards, you know, of our five, you know. kids really are incredibly resilient. We just need to give them the chance to thrive and to be loved. I mean, I told you I was late for our meeting today because my oldest called me and was crying because Prince died. And I jumped in the car and I went and I got her. And that's what kids, even grown-up kids, deserve. That's what they need is responsiveness and love. You know, not indulgence, but love. People who are like devoted to their well-being. And I want all kids to have that. I think a lot of people want all kids to have that. And people feel that they're not capable of doing it themselves. But you know what? You are. People are capable of doing it. And that, in fact, what they're going to probably find out is that their lives are deeply enriched by it.
So I want to make sure I understand. So drop what you're doing, run to your child when a celebrity dies. But if your child, wait a minute. If your child really wants that pair of sunglasses that they saw in the store in the mall, no way. Absolutely not. Do I have your parenting down pat now?
So that's it.
Okay.
Completely random. Either indulge them completely or deny them utterly. Sometimes they don't feed them.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure I was clear. And in mentioning two of your daughters and one of your sons, it occurred to me, really should set this up a little better. So you have five kids. You've raised five kids. Three you've given birth to. Two you've adopted.
Right.
I think you had two daughters first, then you adopted a baby boy, then you had another daughter, and then you adopted the 4.5-year-old, right?
Right. So he's the fourth chronologically, but the fifth to join our family.
Okay.
And so as I say, we produce girls and import boys.
Well, right. And so I should ask you something about your husband's approach to all this. And I know you from reading the book, I know you've driven a lot of this, and he's a community organizer himself. Mm-hmm. He's very passionate, very progressive, and yet five kids, that's a lot of kids. Did he know what he was getting into with you when you married him?
He says he didn't.
That's honest.
He says he did, but he's always game. You know, he was just game for it. Like one time I was saying to somebody, oh, you know, when I first talked to Yosef about adoption, and he said, sweetie, like it's fine to tell the story that way, but just to let you know, you never actually talked to me about it. You brought home papers. And I realized that that was true, but luckily he's kind of an adventurous spirit. And
you carried those papers around with you for years.
I did.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a great little detail that, you know, those papers, you know, you probably would forget your driver's license, but you never forgot where those papers were.
That's right.
And I mentioned I have one kid, and I think about, and we started a little late. We were like in our late 30s, but I think about people who've had two kids and three kids and then five kids that you've had. I my head is underwater with one kid, and the kid's been out of the nest for 2 years.
Yeah.
Generally, forget about adoption. How do you manage raising five kids?
Well, first of all, we are very big into – we love therapy. And we have a parent counselor who we adore. And basically, you know, stuff happens during the week, and then we go to see her on Friday mornings, and we have our little lists, and we're like just like – sometimes I'll pick up my phone and we'll be writing in the notes like word by word what we want to say to the kid. So it's like – it's sort of a combination of paying attention to what we feel is important and letting go what's not.
Okay.
You know, and I think, you know, I know people who have one child, and I feel like they work as hard or harder than we do with our five. Hmm. And of course, it depends. I mean, we have more drama than they'll have because each one of them is going to have their drama. But overall, I think it's sort of things kind of flow, and, you know, and I take sort of like a blunt, what's the term, like I respond with like a blunt, what's the word, to problems, you know? So like, for example, recently two of my three younger kids were not doing their chores. They were just not doing them. And I would bitch about it. And they kind of were like, whatever. So I just stopped buying food. I just stopped buying food in the house. And finally they were like, where's the food? There's no food. And I was like, yeah, I realized that chores were like optional now. And I don't like shopping. And it sort of like just kind of took care of it. You know, I didn't have to get into a big drama. I didn't have to whatever. I just sort of stopped doing my chores too. And then.
So people went a little earlier when you referred to that you just stopped, you just don't feed your kids. They probably thought you were kidding.
They did. Isn't that funny?
Now,
how innocent they are.
So I want to come back to the more serious side of this though for a minute. At the end of the book, and it's nonfiction, so I'm not giving away the ending here, folks. But at the end of the book, you take somewhat surprising aim at groups such as UNICEF and Save the Children. For you say that they're obstructing international adoption. You say that they've caused an international adoption cliff. Resulting in a drop of unparented children adopted by families in the U.S. by two-thirds, from 23,000 in 2004 to just 7,200 in 2013. What's going on here? And most people are probably shocked to hear anybody have a bad word to say about UNICEF and Save the Children. My God, there are commercials every night. Tell me what's going on here.
Yeah, isn't that nice? We get to give lots of money so they can feed kids in institutions. Yeah, well, you know, there's this kind of what I find just bizarre commitment to children being raised in the country in which they were born. That people who promote international adoption as an option for children who are not going to have families in their birth countries are accused of being, you know, colonialists that were just coming and taking, you know, children from developing countries and bringing them to developed countries as a, you know, colonial, you know, old time, you know, taking over the country, you know, through taking the children, or that we're sacrificing the kids' heritage, we're sacrificing the children that the country needs. But you know what? Millions of kids are in institutions and are suffering. And I don't know what kind of heritage UNICEF is imagining kids are getting in these institutions where there's rampant abuse and at worst and at best kind of benign neglect, because the people who run these places and who I think largely are incredible people doing the best they can are just them. They're just limited. They can't do it all. I mean, our older son comes from a beautiful, like a children's home that was beautiful. Nobody in that children's home would choose that them over permanent loving families for each of the children in that orphanage, because they truly loved the children. As the nurse of the place said to me, I said to her, it must be hard for you when the kids leave. And she says, oh, I'm very sad, but I don't regret it. And that still gives me chills.
Now, I was going to say, you live now full-time in Jerusalem, mm-hmm. right? So, but I was thinking about this, and I'm flipping this around. What if the tables were turned a little bit, and there were a lot of kids in Israel, Jewish kids in Israel, who were unparented and were in orphanages? And you know, I'm sure that there are orphanages in Israel, as there are anywhere. But would-be parents from, say, Brazil or Ecuador or Mexico, they wanted to adopt Israeli kids. Would Israelis, who weren't even close to the situation, but in general as a culture, how would they feel about people from other countries taking Israeli kids and taking them off to Ecuador or Mexico or Canada or, you know, would that be, you know, do you think that would be a different issue or is it the same issue?
I think that it would be similar to other countries. There would be people who would want them to be, you know, in some sacrifice to the heritage, to Judaism. And there would be people who would say, put them in homes, give them permanent loving families. I think it would be mixed like any other place. Personally, how do I feel? I feel like I would be sad because I like Judaism. I think it's a good way to orient ourselves in the world, but I would never sacrifice a child to that. I mean, to me, I'm a rabbi, right? So obviously, I like being Jewish. But to me, being Jewish, and I kind of imagine this for all ways of being in the world, all cultures, it's like a world of metaphors and paradigms and rituals and values with which we orient ourselves in the world. It's not a god that we sacrifice to. It's a way of being. And I find it a meaningful way to be, of being. I think that it's a worthy way of being, that it contributes, you know, its weight in the world in its own ways, as other cultures do as well. But it's not a, it's, you know, we're sacrificing children on the altar of this thing we call heritage. And I don't care if it's Jewish or it's some other, you know, it's some other culture. We can't do that. Mm-hmm. We would never sacrifice ourselves. I mean, would we ever say to a gay Iranian who fled, what are you doing? Your culture is to be beheaded. You can't leave your culture. You owe your heritage that. Like, we would never say this to adults. Can you imagine if, like, millions of white males were in institutions because we felt that was their heritage? I mean, women, this happens to all the time, right? I mean, who cares? And children, yeah. Who cares?
What's changed in the decade of that you cite in the book at these organizations where they, I mean, because, you know, we have this ongoing debate in the United States now about commercialized prisons, basically, where we've turned up. Right. Okay. So you know where I'm going with this. So prisons have been turned over to for profit contractors, and the only way that they make money is if we maintain laws that keep shipping people off to prison. The Hillary Clinton's gotten in trouble for this issue of late because her husband supported this back in the 90s a bit. But the reason I bring that up is, so kind of what it sounds like you're talking about is that Save the Children and UNICEF are soliciting as much money as they always have, but their goal is now institutionalized children as opposed to taking children from bad situations or whatever and finding them homes. It sounds like you're saying that they want to just keep housing kids, that's their idea of a solution. And I'm wondering what's changed.
Well, they don't say that, but that's the reality. And it hasn't, I mean, the decrease in adoptions, first of all, the number of adoptions originally were still a drop in the bucket of kids who are institutionalized, right? So the fact that decreased, it's like, I keep wanting to say it's a shanda. It's like a shame on all of us. You know, if we, UNICEF and all of us, if we wanted to prioritize kids and families, we could make it happen. We don't. What is in people's hearts around this? I don't know. I know what people say and how there's something called the subsidiary principle, which is that we need to find out if the kid can be kept with their family. If not kept with their family, reunited with their family. If not reunited with their immediate family, reunited with extended family. If not reunited with extended family, then adopted within country. If not adopted within country, then internationally adopted. If not internationally adopted, then kept in institutions. But the international adoption piece is often basically skipped. First of all. Second of all, every single day a kid lives in an institution damages that child. So if we wanted to figure out how to process kids quickly, to find out what the situation is quickly, we could do it. We just don't. Mm. And I'm involved with an organization now called Both Ends Burning. And Both Ends Burning is working with these incredible high-tech companies that are working for data collection, because that's the first step. Why are we not collecting data? Why are we not making it available for birth mothers to anonymously but verifiably say when a kid is born and whether they want to relinquish that child? Right? Why are we not doing this? Why is there no database? There's just not. And so, we don't care enough.
So how is your organization different, operating differently than the more established and better-known groups?
So, well, my organization is actually not dealing with the international, the policy and the law around it, although I'm involved with people who are. But because I'm involved with this organization, I've got to know ministers of welfare from, you know, 25 different countries internationally who are saying, we don't want kids in institutions anymore. We do. We'd love for them to be to stay home, to stay with their birth families, but we're not willing to sacrifice them for the sake of our heritage anymore. We want to figure out how to get kids in permanent loving families quickly and with justice as well, so that we make sure that, you know, families, birth families are given every opportunity. So because I have these relationships now, I'm starting to talk to people, for example, in Brazil, where all infants and small children get families, get adopted within Brazil, which is an amazing thing. And because they're also increasing their data on their own, they're doing this. But older kids aren't getting families in Brazil. And so they want to say, how can we place older kids? And they've recently changed the law so that gay and lesbian people can adopt, which is amazing. So now I'm working with them saying, wow, I know a lot of, you know, synagogues where there are gay and lesbian singles or couples who would love to adopt. Let's work together. And he said, great, let's do it. So we're starting that path. I'm working with Nepal to create a Nepal-Israel relationship for adoption. Also, they have about 350 kids who now need permanent loving families abroad, who do not have any family options in Nepal. And they're all older kids. So my job in Israel is to go around and say, okay, people, like, we can do this, to go to a kibbutz or to, you know, some kind of communal living and say, wow, you know, don't you have 10 families here who could adopt, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, you know, up to like 15-year-old from Nepal, and see if we can get, you know, 10 kids from Nepal on the same kibbutz together in their own families. We can make this happen if we prioritize it. So I'm not working on the international level with my organization. I'm working with other organizations who are doing that and trying to place my organization in relationship with these ministries of welfare internationally so that we can find homes for these kids.
Okay. Let me ask you this. Non-Jews, people who may have had not a lot of experience with rabbis, who I think in many ways are a little different culturally than priests and ministers and what have you, and I'll point out what I'm getting at. They may be surprised to find language in your book that is maybe more typical of Sister Sarah and less so what they expect of a rabbi, such as when you tell your first two kids, the girls, that they're going to have a little brother, and they respond by asking, can we get pizza, which seems fine, and then as they run away, out of their earshot, you turn to your husband and refer to them as self-centered little shits. Were you concerned? Which is fine. I mean, I get the joke. It's, you know, it's funny. We're parents. I know what we're thinking is not always what we're saying. But were you concerned, though, that referring to your own kids that way, and as early as page 7, I might point out, that might alienate potential adoptive parents reading your book who you're trying to encouraged to adopt, but maybe they're thinking, well, maybe this woman's approach isn't quite what we had in mind.
Right. Listen, that could be. It could be. I don't know who I'm going to sort of like bring closer to the idea of adoption or who I'm going to alienate. I mean, you know, like my sister, you know, there's some ways people that she sort of like hits a truth in them that they get and they feel inspired by. And some people are just disgusted. And that's how it is. And that's, I can't tell any story except my own.
Right.
Honestly. And I felt that, I mean, to tell it honestly. Right. So I felt that it was better told than not told. And then once I made that decision, it was just going to be an honest story.
I mean, I laughed at things like that. I mean, and you know, what I talked about earlier about you being a bit of an alarmist and worrying about people, you know, never making it or coming home. And I liked that. And I mentioned Bob Alper, who's a friend, who's a rabbi turned comedian. I have known enough rabbis that it's not, they don't really look at life and they don't talk the same way that a lot of ministers and priests do, who, you know, everything's got to be perfect. And they're, you know, oh, we never use that language. And so, but, you know, I thought, maybe it's a little counterproductive, but I don't know. So I was just curious. Last question, really, because I know you need to get going, but you talk a lot about your kids and your husband and yourself. You tell stories. You tell the story about Jeffrey, and obviously your grandparents are not around to rebut the story. But anytime someone does something like this that is memoir and autobiographical, there's that line that you cross about in terms of telling too much, TMI kind of thing. Did you ever feel that maybe you were telling too much, or that you needed to pull back, or you know, this is just Susan Silverman, and this is who you are?
Well, you know, writing the book, I would sit in a cafe with a friend who was also writing a book every day and just write, and it was sort of so insular that I almost forgot people would read it. And I just said to myself, anyway, like, I'm just going to write my truth. And then if I should be so lucky that it gets published, I will go back. And then when I got a publisher, I was sort of like in this role and I forgot to kind of really analyze what I wanted to say. And then when I got the book and I was leafing through it, I was like, oh my fucking God, Like, did I really not look at this and take this out or ask my child? So I am kind of concerned about that now.
Well, I don't mean to pile on. It's okay.
Yeah, it's okay.
It's a very informative book. It's at times a very funny book. It's really interesting. It's more than I expected I would, focus on regarding that world. Also, being someone who's getting out of that raising a child thing, I can't go back. I can't do it again. Anyway, folks, listen, you can find Rabbi Susan Silverman's book, Casting Lots, Creating a Family in a Beautiful Broken World, in great bookstores everywhere, or you can order it. And her first book as well, she has another one, right now at MrMedia.com, MRMedia.com. If you are watching this video on MrMedia.com, just to the right under the video, you'll see the cover of the book. Click on it right now. You can get it electronically, get the ebook in seconds, or Amazon can use a drone and maybe get it out to you in 30 minutes or so. Me, I would order a pizza in 30 minutes and have the book shipped and get it in a day or two. But, you got to do whatever you want to do, folks. And Susan, tell folks again what the website is you'd like them to go and check out.
So my organization is called Second Nurture, and the URL is communityadoption.org.
Communityadoption.org. And are you you with the group, Twitter, Facebook, any of that kind of stuff?
Rabbi Susan on Twitter and Facebook at Second Nurture and Casting Lots, which is the name of the book.
Excellent, excellent. Well, Rabbi Susan Silverman, delightful to talk to you. We've had an interesting day together. I know that you're heading from here to Harvard Square Bookstore. Good luck there. It's a great place to have a signing. And thank you so much for joining us in Mr. Media today.
Thank you so much for your patience and kindness. I really enjoyed speaking with you. Do you edit these?
Yeah. All in, yeah.